Good evening, everyone. It's time to take charge of your life. Hello, this is marriage and family therapist Eleanor Barbaro, your host, inviting you to take charge of your life on WDIY. The theme of this program is that so many events in life happen to us over which we have no control. Our only control is our response to life's situations. It is often said that 90% of life's events happen to us, and 10% is what we make happen. Tonight we talk about a topic that is difficult to discuss. I wish we didn't have to talk about it, but recent events have called attention to young people who commit horrific acts of school violence. Peer harassment and social ostracism have been cast as major triggers, but my guest this evening, Dr. Peter Langman, argues that the problem resides deep within the psyche of the shooters. He's written an outstanding book entitled Why Kids Kill, Inside the Minds of School Shooters, and he is kind enough to be a guest this evening on Take Charge of Your Life so that we may understand the psychological causes and issues of school shootings and why certain teens exhibit the potential to kill. Dr. Peter Langman is a psychologist in private practice whose book, Why Kids Kill, was named a Choice Outstanding Academic by the American Library Association and has been translated into German, Finnish, and Dutch. It is a pleasure to welcome Dr. Peter Langman to WDIY.
Thank you, Ellie. It's nice to be here.
Dr. Langman, what made you think about writing this book?
Well, it all began actually on April 30th, 1999. As you might remember, April 20th, 1999, there was the attack at Columbine High School.
Yes.
And at that time, I was doing my doctoral training in psychology at Kids Peace Hospital in Orfield. 10 days after Columbine, there was a 16-year-old boy who came through the hospital because he was seen as a risk for committing a school shooting. And I was assigned the task of evaluating him for homicide risk.
That's right here in the Lehigh Valley you're talking about.
Yes.
Yes, okay.
He was the first of a pretty steady trickle of potential school shooters who came through the hospital. So that's what triggered my interest in this phenomenon, because I was faced with the task of working with these young men and trying to determine if they were a serious risk or not.
And did any of the young men that you saw at the time have the potential?
I think some of them did. And actually, I use the term young men, but there were also a couple of young women as well who were potential school shooters who had thoughts about committing rampage violence.
But none of these young people that you saw at that time acted out their potential?
No, none of them went on to commit the act that they had been contemplating.
Yeah. And what is the difference, do you think, in events like in Aurora, Colorado? What's the difference in young shooters in that episode?
Well, that obviously was not a school shooting, but I think the young man who committed that act may be very similar to those who commit school shootings.
Would he have been observable in the school setting or in another setting of having these potential possibilities for violent acts as he did in Aurora, Colorado?
Well, actually, just this morning, I saw an article online that the psychiatrist at the university where he had been a doctoral student had warned the police that he was a homicide risk. So I don't know what she knew that gave her that impression, but at least one person saw that potential for violence was there.
But nothing was responded to.
I don't know what the response was. A lot of the records have not yet been made public in that case.
So let's talk about some of the warning signs or perhaps we ought to talk about the three different types of potential shooters that you write about in your book.
Okay. I'm going to take each of these in turn, but to start with, the three types are what I call the psychopathic, the psychotic, and the traumatized. So I want to start with the psychopathic as the first type of school shooter. Case example of a psychopathic school shooter would be Eric Harris from Columbine. And the term psychopath refers to a certain personality. And that personality is one that's very narcissistic, does not have really the capacity for empathy, guilt or remorse. They kind of live outside the social norms, the laws, the morality that the rest of us live in. So when you read Eric Harris's journal, you see a lot of comments about there's no such thing as true good and true evil. And morals is just another word. It has no meaning.
That's from his perspective.
Yes.
That's in his journal.
Right. And you see in his journal and his website a lot of really narcissistic, grandiose comments. He liked to sign people's yearbooks in German, Ich bin Gott, which means I am God. And he wrote in his journal he wishes he were God because that would mean everyone was officially beneath him. And he knew he wasn't God. He was not delusional, but he was obsessed with the idea that he was superior to everybody else. So he was superior, he rejected morality, and he had a sadistic streak. He wrote in his journal, for example, about his fantasies of tricking girls he knew at school up into his room and then raping them. And he had fantasies about taking a knife and just mutilating a human body. So you see this total lack of feeling for other people and no concern for the impact of his actions.
No compassion, no empathy. And he was in charge. He was, as he put it, he was God.
Right. And he had written to a friend in a chat room that he wanted to have the power of life and death. He wanted to be able to be godlike. And on April 20th, 1999, he got to play God in that sense and decide who lived and who died.
And he committed.
He and Dylan Klebold killed 13 people and wounded 23 others at Columbine.
So he really lived out his fantasy.
Right.
And there was no one around to be aware that he was a danger.
There were some warning signs, but no one saw what was coming. You know, Eric had been caught making a pipe bomb. And his parents told him, you know, don't make any more pipe bombs. And he went right on making them, but told his parents, oh, no, I'm not doing that anymore. And that's another aspect of the psychopathic personality. They're often very good at deceiving people, and they take pride in their ability to lie and pull the wool over people's eyes. And Eric bragged in his journals about what a great liar he was. And that's where you see like con artists, the ability to make a good impression, charm people, all the while you're planning to exploit them or hurt them in some way.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Take Charge of Your Life. And this evening, I'm talking with my guest, Dr. Peter Langman, who is a psychologist in private practice. And he has written about why kids kill. He's gotten into the minds and he's done the research, looked at their diaries, looked at their thinking, and has come up with an amazing analysis of why kids kill. And as I mentioned earlier, I didn't really want to do this. Wasn't interested in this subject. I wanted to push it away. But it's so important that we cannot ignore it, because that's what people did with these people who became killers. Is that right, Doug?
That's true. There were often warning signs that people did not pick up on.
Parents did not pick up on these signals. The schools did not pick up on these signals.
Occasionally, people did see things that got them concerned, but without evidence that there was an attack coming up, they could not really take any action. So they might talk to the student who would say, no, it was just a story I wrote, or I didn't really mean it, or talk to the parents. But the kids hadn't broken any laws that anyone was aware of, and did not appear to be a threat. So the warning signs, even when they did draw some attention, did not result in any real intervention.
Now, you mentioned there are three types of shooters, psychopathic. One is psychopathic, and the others are?
Psychotic and traumatized.
And what's the psychotic?
Psychotic shooter would be someone like Kip Kinkle from Oregon in 1998. He was 15 years old. And for the 3 years, he had been hearing voices talking to him, telling him to kill himself, telling him to kill other people. He had a very early onset of schizophrenia. So he was not fully functioning in reality. He had the auditory hallucinations, the voices talking to him. He also had paranoid delusions. So He lived his life in fear of imminent attack from China. He thought he was going to have to defend his home when the Chinese invaded, for example. He thought maybe the government had put a computer chip in his brain that was broadcasting the voices. So a very different type of person than Eric Harris. Kip did have empathy. He did have a conscience, but he was very mentally ill.
And then the third kind is the traumatized person.
Right. A good example of this would be Jeffrey Weiss, who was 16 in 2005 at Red Lake, Minnesota, which is a Native American reservation where he lived. And he had been very abused by his alcoholic mother. His father had committed suicide when Jeffrey was 7. Jeffrey bounced around from different homes, lived in foster care, was very depressed and suicidal. Just a life full of tragic losses. His mother was in a car accident and suffered brain damage. So he had lost his father to suicide, his mother to brain damage. Even when his mother had been around, she was an alcoholic who abused him. Just a very terrible life as a child.
So these are the three major types. And what I'd like to discuss with you, Dr. Peter Langman, author of Why Kids Kill. I'd like to discuss with you in the second half of our program, what can we do? What are the warning signs? And what can we as a community do so that we prevent this from happening, so that we are on the alert and not nonchalant about this kind of behavior that evidently we see in front of us but tend to either ignore or do not pay attention to the signs. So we'll talk about that when we return to Take Charge of Your Life on WDIY.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Sovereign Performing Arts Center Reading, announcing the appearance of comedian, author, TV host, and actress Joan Rivers, live and in person, as she speaks about her 135 years in show business, sharing personal stories and experiences in the intimate setting of the Sovereign Performing Arts Center, Friday, April 26th. Tickets at the box office, Ticketmaster.com, or 800-745-3000.
For program support on WDIY, we thank the Cedar Crest College School of Adult and Graduate Education Master in Art Therapy, where you can channel your love for the arts and healthcare in this growing field while learning to help others emotionally, mentally, and physically through the creation of art. More information at sage.cedarcrest.edu.
Welcome back to Take Charge of Your Life. Hello, this is Eleanor Bobrow, your host. And this evening, we're talking with Dr. Peter Langman, a psychologist in private practice in the Lehigh Valley, who's written an outstanding book called Why Kids Kill. It was named a Choice Outstanding Academic title from the American Library Association, was translated into German, Finnish, and Dutch. And we were talking in the first part of the program about profiles of different types of young people who kill, the psychopathic, The psychotic, and the traumatized.
Yes.
What I'd like to do in this part of the program, Dr. Peter Langman, is talk about what are the warning signs that we, as parents, as members of the school faculty, what can we notice as warning signs, and what can we do to prevent it?
Okay. When you're talking about prevention, the key term there is what's called threat assessment. Mm. You know, kids often say things that they might not mean. So someone might make a threat like, you do that to me again, I'm going to kill you. And it may not be anything he intends literally, but sometimes someone might make a threat and he does mean it literally. So the process of threat assessment is evaluating what kids say to determine if there's a threat. So what schools really need is a team of trained people within their staff who know how to investigate and evaluate a threat when it comes to their attention. So what that process really is about is training as many people as possible, the faculty, the staff, and most importantly, the students, in what to look for. What are the warning signs?
So what are some of the warning signs?
Well, the key term here is what's called leakage, when people leak their intentions. And kids do that in a number of different ways. Sometimes they brag about what they're going to do. And there was a case in 1998 in Jonesboro, Arkansas. Andrew Golden stood on the table in the cafeteria and announced, I'm going to bring a gun and kill all of you. Sometimes it's that direct, but he was 11 years old. No one took him seriously. No one told the adults that he had made that threat. So any direct threat has to be taken seriously. Other times it's not so direct. A student might say to a friend, don't come to school tomorrow because I'm going to bring a gun or something bad is going to happen. So it's a warning to friends sometimes to stay away. Other times a kid will try to recruit a peer to join him in the attack. And if that peer then reports that invitation to a teacher or a parent, there's room for intervention and prevention of the attack. So kids often kind of advertise what their intentions are. And if the students and the faculty are all trained in recognizing that kind of leakage, then you can effectively intervene.
I'm wondering if there was that kind of leakage with the Newtown, the recent episode in Newtown, Connecticut, with Adam Laser. I'm wondering if there was that kind of evidence noted by anyone.
Well, with Adam Monza, he was living an isolated life, so he was not at a school, so there were no peers he could have said anything to unless he was communicating with someone online, but nothing of that sort has come to light. Plus, he was 20 years old and he attacked an elementary school, so the school didn't have him on their radar in any way because he was not a student there. So that attack would have been very difficult to prevent.
So, but there are situations where we can be on the lookout for clues and warning signs, one of which was leakage. Is there another kind of clue we can look for?
Well, sometimes the shooters have a long history of being obsessed with guns, with violence, with murder. Sometimes they idolize other killers. So if students are writing papers or posting messages online praising Harrison Klebold from Columbine, seeing them as heroes, that could be an indication that they're at risk for violence themselves.
So what is, another possibility is looking for the sign of interest in guns.
Not just interest in guns, but a real obsession with them.
Obsession, I think that's a good
word. Not just because they go hunting, but just because they're, in essence, in love with weapons. And some of them have that kind of obsession, to use that word again. So it's not just they like guns, they go hunting with their father or something. It's beyond that.
I'm glad you clarified that.
Yeah.
So it's not just an interest in, it's an obsession with guns.
And not just guns, but often, as with Eric Harris, with violence, with mutilating people, with other killers. Harris was obsessed with the Nazis and Hitler. You see that among a number of school shooters. Sung Hui Cho was influenced by Eric Harris. So when they idolize people who commit mass violence, that could be a warning sign that they're planning something along the same lines.
So there are signs that we can look for. But how can we? So let us say that we get the leakage and we respond to the leakage. Maybe something was written in a class composition, or somebody in class in the eighth grade got up and said something, I'm going to kill everybody tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Let us just say we get that. What can we do to prevent it?
Well, that's where threat assessment comes in. You interview the student. You interview people who know the student. Maybe you get a search warrant and search the home. You look at the computer. You see if there's illegal weapons, whether it's guns or bombs that have been made and stashed somewhere. If there's been a law broken in terms of weapons, then law enforcement can get involved. If there's been a direct threat to someone, law enforcement could get involved if it's a terroristic threat, because that's illegal. There may be mental health involvement. Maybe you get him into a psychiatric hospital or a long-term residential treatment program where he can be kept safe until he's stable. So there's different things that can happen depending on the circumstances.
But what you're saying is we can't ignore it.
Right.
And what has happened in the past too often, I'm not sure if it's happening that way now, Dr. Langman. I don't know if you see that as much now. But certainly in the past, there was ignoring of these little signs. And we said, oh, he was too young, he's 11. We ignored the signs that were apparent, and we did nothing. But I'm not sure that we're in a position in this day and age to do nothing. And what you're saying is that we need to take action and to investigate at the very least, investigate the possibilities of what's going on.
Definitely. It may not be a real threat, like I said at the beginning, but you have to investigate it because you don't know until you conduct that assessment.
Have you known of any threats that were made where an assessment was made and something was prevented?
That happens a good bit, actually. Those stories typically don't make the news too often.
Well, I'm glad you're mentioning that. Yeah. I want us to be.
You know, dozens, if not hundreds, of potential attacks have been foiled, most often because students come forward because they're the ones who are most likely to hear comments from their peers. And potential attacks have been prevented.
I want something that goes on in the schools a great deal is bullying. And I'm wondering, does bullying have an impact on some of these potential shooters?
I think the focus on bullying is important but exaggerated. Some school shooters have been bullied. Many, however, have not. And in some cases, the school shooters have been the bullies. They've been the tough guys, the threatening, intimidating kids who then take it to the next step and commit murder. So anything we can do to eliminate or minimize bullying is wonderful, but we can't assume that even if we could do that, it would prevent all school shootings because many school shooters have not been bullied.
If we gave you, if we could wave a magic wand, Dr. Paul Langman. Dr. Peter Langman, thank you. Dr. Peter Langman, if we could wave a magic wand and give you complete authority to design a program of prevention, mental health for the schools, what would that look like?
Well, I'd have everyone trained, or people trained at every school to conduct threat assessments.
Would everybody be trained or certain individuals?
Everyone would be educated about warning signs, but only certain people would need to be trained to conduct the threat assessments. And my vision for mental health care would be same way we start children with annual physical checkups, that everyone would have an annual mental health checkup starting maybe at age 5 throughout their lives, so you catch things early. So if someone is having the early onset of schizophrenia or is so depressed that he's thinking of killing himself and maybe other people, we catch that long before it results in violence.
So what you're suggesting is just as we do in evaluating kindergartners with their reading ability and where they stand academically, you're suggesting a mental health evaluation.
Right. We all get our, hopefully, dental checkups, eye checkups, physical checkups. It's scheduled. It's just part of what we expect and demand in healthcare, but we don't do that for mental health.
Now, it's interesting, those checkups that you were just mentioning, dental and eye, et cetera, we do that yearly. Are you suggesting that we need a yearly checkup of our youngsters?
Yeah, I would say youngsters and adults too, because there's adults who commit all kinds of violence, not just school shootings. And if we can minimize depression, cut down the suicide risk, the divorce rate, cut down violent crime, starting in childhood but continuing through the lifespan, why don't we provide mental health checkups?
Well, that's a very interesting suggestion, making mental health a yearly checkup and starting in the kindergarten.
I think it's time we took mental health as seriously as we take physical health.
I think that's an excellent point, and I want to thank you for coming in, Dr. Peter Langman, author of Why Kids Kill, for helping us to identify the early signs of possible violence and some possible preventative measures that parents and educators can take to protect their communities. I particularly like the idea of a yearly mental health checkup. That sounds very innovative but important. The book is a major contribution to the field of child psychology and a look into how unprocessed human pain can end in tragedy. Thank you so much for helping us to look at a problem we didn't want to look at.
Thank you.
But as a result, we have gained insight as to how to prevent future tragedies. Thank you again, Dr. Peter Langman. Thank you again for listening. Thank you, Neil Heaver, producer. See you all on the radio next Monday evening at 6:30 p.m. when I again invite you to take charge of your life on WDIY.